Indie Media is DIY news. It is about people reporting their own news directly without the need for reporters, bypassing the corporate media.
There are 100 Indie Media or IMC websites worldwide providing grassroots reports of struggles, campaigns and protests.
There are so many people here who are saying no to the government today, and this is democracy in action.
Everybody's here. Everybody in the country seems to be here. They're just coming from all over the place. The banners are showing all the tiny, tiny little pockets of the country. Everybody has come down here.
The project started 3 years ago covering the massive Seattle protests which shut down the World Trade Organization summit.
Uncensored and unsponsored, IMC sites can be updated anywhere, anytime, by anyone.
The open to all nature of these sites means that you can publish your own reports about your own issues and at the same time connect to a global network of grassroots news.
What you're about to hear are some of the highlights.
What you are about to hear are some highlights from these global websites and from our very own UK IMC Wire. For more information or to get the news direct from the streets, check out www.indiemedia.org.uk.
The world is waking outside my window. Bella ciao, bella ciao, bella ciao, ciao, ciao. Drags my senses into the sunlight, for there are things that I must do. Wish me luck now, I have to leave you. Bella ciao, bella ciao, bella ciao, ciao, ciao. With my friends now, up to the city. We're gonna shake the gates of hell, and I will tell them, we will tell them.
Hi and welcome to the show. It's Wednesday the 18th of February and this is Indie Media Radio London on Resonance FM 104.4. Well, 10 years ago, hundreds of anti-Rhodes protesters were evicted from a row of houses in Wanstead by an army of 600 police, security guards and bailiffs. The houses were flattened to make way for the infamous M11 Link Road through East London. This and many of the following protests were to define the way for increasingly diverse direct action for years to come. The M11 Link Road had to be one of the most unjustified road schemes bulldozed through during the Thatcher government's insane greatest road building programme since the Romans. 1,000 residents were to be evicted by the demolition of 300 plus houses in a swathe of destruction through Wanstead, Leighton and Leytonstone. It went against all of the planning guidelines, funneling yet more traffic towards the centre of London. It had been planned decades previously in a time when few people predicted that you cannot indefinitely build your way out of traffic congestion, because traffic invariably grows to fill any newly built road to its maximum capacity. No financial cost was ever placed on the communities being ripped apart, the effects of climate change, pollution, priceless landscapes destroyed and so on. It was because of this appalling bias in favour of reckless road building that the direct action campaign against such senseless destruction sprang up in the early 90s, starting at Twyford Down, a famous beauty spot near Winchester. Once protests at Twyford Down had subsided, the focus moved to the distinctly urban M11 Link Road campaign and to many other sites around the country. After every legal challenge was lost in the High Court, campaigners then used any means that their bodies and imaginations could come up with to obstruct the destruction at every step by squatting condemned buildings, living in trees and invading the work sites and stopping everything by placing their bodies in the way of the machinery. At first, with the M11 campaign, local support was sparse, but this dramatically changed when an 8-foot-high fence was erected around a 250-year-old sweet chestnut tree on George Green in Wanstead. Wanstonians, the people living there, were furious at this, and they had always been led to believe that the village green would be untouched because the road would pass underneath in a tunnel. One Saturday, when an inadequate number of security guards and police were on duty, they could only watch in amazement when an extraordinary display of spontaneous revolt took place, as local schoolchildren and adults, as well as seasoned activists, flattened every square metre of the fence, burning the posts and using some of the panels to build a treehouse in the reclaimed tree. Finally, 400 police swarmed into Wanstead to enforce the felling of this single tree. Despite entirely passive resistance by 250 protesters surrounding the tree, the police resorted to appalling levels of violence, punching children and pensioners in the face. This was the day that the campaign made it big on the mainstream media, and the national TV news that evening showed crowds of Wanstead women and children in floods of tears as the digger callously tore the tree from its roots in the name of progress. The policing costs for the day were £100,000, and this was to be one of many increasingly costly and high-profile operations during the life of the M11 campaign.
The people of Wanstead and fellow protesters were so sickened by the government's brutal determination to push this road scheme through that they created the Independent Free Area of Wanstonia by declaring unilateral independence from the British state for numbers 2 to 12 Cambridge Park. This was the next group of elegant but decaying Edwardian houses due to be demolished, right next to the green where the sweet chestnut tree had recently been fought over. Wanstonia passport were printed and distributed to friendlies. Official-looking letters were duly sent off to the Foreign Office and the UN, and a massive barricading operation began to prepare for the next onslaught. And so, 10 years ago, just after dawn, the police Operation Barnard kicked off right on cue as 37 riot vans and several police coaches glided into Cambridge Park Road like one long express train, and about 600 police and security guards surrounded the street. Bailiffs then set about smashing every window and door of the barricaded houses, using sledgehammers and crowbars, and slowly dragging protesters one by one from the inside. The campaigners and locals had an absolute ethic of non-violence then, and not a single tile or brick was thrown from the roofs, and yet the bailiffs took terrible risk with people's lives as they performed a vicious tug-of-war with people's limbs and bodies suspended way above the ground. This impressive and costly eviction was followed up by Operation Roadblock, a month of rota-based daily direct action, where campaign and direct action groups booked in which days they would take action. It worked remarkably well, with sizeable disruption to the road building every day throughout March. Elsewhere, many of the resistance techniques developed at the M11, both for the defence of houses and trees, were now being used against other schemes. And then, in late 1994, a political hand grenade was thrown into the mix, the Criminal Justice and Public Order Act. Overnight, civil protesting became a criminal act, but what the government hadn't counted on was how this piece of legislation would unite and motivate the very groups it was aimed at repressing. The fight of the anti-road activists became synonymous with that of travellers, squatters and hunt saboteurs. In particular, the suddenly politicised rave scene became a communal social focus for many people. Resistance united people and pushed the DIY approach to party, protest and politics. The latter stages of 1994 also saw the creation of Schnews, the first Undercurrents video magazine, and of course, out of the ashes of the M11 campaign came Reclaim the Streets.
Here's a question for you. Are all these new PC and console games actually any better than games in the classic 8-bit gaming era? Waka 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 waka. In the old days, it actually had to be good with your joystick. Now you can beat the crap out of your mates just by squashing the controller buttons at random. How much skill involved there? Waka 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 waka. In the old days, it actually had to be good with your joystick. Crap out of your mates just by squashing the controller buttons at random. How much skill involved there? I'm not saying all new games is shocking, 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 shocking. In the old days, it actually had to be good with your joystick. Now you can beat the crap out of your mates just by squashing the controller buttons at random. How much skill involved there? Wackle, 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 wackle. cost under a tenner, when you didn't have to upgrade your system to actually run them, when you could play a game and not complete the whole thing on your first go.
Oh yeah, baby!
I remember the good old days. Games cost under a tenner, when you didn't have to upgrade your system to actually run them, when you could play a game and not complete the whole thing on your first go. Shut up!
And now, fast forward 10 years to the present day. This is the Anti-Roads Movement Part 2. Things have turned a full circle and a whole new generation are on board. This week there are several separate protest camps, all on urgent eviction alert. Ecological direct action and resistance is back on the map as new road schemes and developments continue to be announced. Three tree and environmental defence camps are on eviction alert as we speak. Blackwood near Newport, Sherwood Forest in Nottingham and Nine Ladies in Derbyshire are all competing for people prepared to take a stand. Many people are now wondering if we are headed back to the protest camp days of the 90s. With news that the Hastings bypass, which was rejected in 2001 on environmental grounds, is to be pressed ahead by the Highways Agency, but under a different name. Yesterday's outlawing of the highway agencies of the controversial government plans to reroute roads around Stonehenge. And news that the company Tarmac intends to press ahead with quarrying expansion at Thumbra Neolithic Henge, which has been described as the only triple henge alignment in the world. It seems would be Earth Defenders will be split for choice. And now news of the three campaign camps resisting the destruction eviction from the authorities.
5 acres of St David's Wood in Blackwood, South Wales, is currently under threat of being trashed for the sake of an access road to an industrial park, and would have already been destroyed if it wasn't for some hardy protesters and a 10-year local campaign which has involved two High Court battles. The decade-long campaign to save the woods came to a head recently when Carefully County Borough County Council signed a contract with Serhow Enterprise Way to begin work on the £54 million bypass, despite receiving some 4,500 written objections from locals. Compulsory purchase orders to acquire the land have now been served, and the contractors, Costain and Tarmac, have begun felling trees. These campaigners say they need urgent help to protect the site. But before you go down to the woods, you'd better leaf through some of the dusty pages of Hogwarts' book on tree protest wizardry. Now, we know that magic can happen down in the woods, but things got truly surreal last week when something called Harry Potter weaved its spell into the story. Now, that's not as daft as it seems. A new development has come about because contractors Costain and Carefully Borough Council have used the obscure Harry Potter legal ruling to secure a High Court injunction on the entire camp of protesters at Blackwood. In the Harry Potter legal case, some of the Harry Potter documents went missing from the publishing company Bloomsbury and were then given to the press before publication. Because the company didn't know the specific names of the persons who had taken the documents, they simply described them to the court. The court then decided that for the first time, that people who hadn't been described, rather than actually named, could be defendants to an injunction. So what this means, essentially, is that an injunction can now be served against anybody without naming anyone. and therefore any person entering or remaining in the specified area, in this case the woodland under threat at Blackwood, can be immediately removed. Bindmans, the solicitors who are giving free legal advice to the camp, said this is the first time this Harry Potter ruling has been used against protesters. Last week, the Welsh Assembly itself made Costain stop all work on the site due to the presence of protected species. However, the next day, Costain secured the legal application required to continue trashing the woodland. Despite this, resistance has been continuing. Protesters, local campaigners and schoolchildren have all been throwing themselves in front of the machinery and chainsaw crews to defend the trees, even in the face of violence from Costain's contractors. On several days, work has been fully stopped, and in one incident, a chainsaw crew member broke down and refused to continue working when faced with a teenage girl determined to save the woodland. The campaigners now fear that an eviction of the two camps could be imminent, but their spirits remain high, partly due to the incredibly high level of local support. One message of support on a website reads, "If you only ever make it to one tree protest, make it Blackwood. Here you can make a difference, because here they can win."
You're listening to Resonance 104.4 on... No, we're on Resonance 104.4, and you're listening to the Indie Media Radio London show. And next up is an interview recorded last week by Indie Media Sheffield with one of the protesters at the Nine Ladies protest camp, where the Bronze Age Nine Ladies Stone Circle ain't... I'll start this again. Where the Bronze Age Nine Lady Stone Circle Ancient Monument, that's quite a mouthful, and the surrounding moorland are under threat from massive quarrying expansion. However, the 32-acre site has been occupied for 4 years by protesters who have already built more than 25 tree houses and dug a complex of tunnels and defences in the stone. A High Court case last week gave the Stancliffe Stone Company permission to evict them, but the campaigners now expect hundreds of people to join them in defending the ancient monuments and surrounding countryside.
Protest camp up at Nine Ladies in the Peak District National Park has been here since September 1999 and we've just been served our papers. The quarry company have been given a possession order, and we're anticipating an eviction at any moment now. The protest site is against the reopening of two dormant quarries, which are situated kind of between Bakewell and Matlock, and it's officially Peak District National Park, so really it shouldn't be touched at all. The site's actually called Nine Ladies Anti-Quarry Site because the area of the proposed quarries would actually go within 100 metres of the Nine Ladies Stone Circle, which is up on Stanton Moor. Stanton Moor is one of the most archaeologically rich areas in the UK. There are four stone circles up there, and the Nine Ladies and the outlying Kingstone are one of them. It's a really, really amazing moorland. It's a gritstone moorland that's covered in heather and birch trees, and the site would go within 100 metres just down the hillside. So the whole area is going to be completely destroyed. The views, the atmosphere. It's a really beautiful area. It's on a hillside. You can see right across the valleys, and this really is the last opportunity to come and try and stop these plans for a quarry in a national park, which is supposed to be preserved, not just for the people of Britain, but for the people all over the world. It's a national park. This should not be destroyed for the profit of some company that wants to ship stone out to America and make pavements with it. The company that want to reopen the two quarries are Stancliffe Stone, but in June 2001, they were bought out by Marshalls PLC, which is a big building materials company. Marshalls are really, really big. They've got a lot of money, a lot of influence. The site is 35 acres, and it's spread over a wooded hillside, which is all regenerated quarry. The most recent area on site that was quarried was over 50 years ago, and a lot of other parts have been left for longer than that. At the moment, the quarry company are trying to claim that the quarries are actually active and not dormant. Now, in 1995, after the Environment Act, all the quarries in the country had to be classified as active or dormant, and Lees Cross and Encliffe were classified as dormant, and Stancliffe didn't object at all to those classifications. But now they're suggesting, with their very good barrister, that they're actually active because they got the permission in 1952. All three quarries got given permission, and Dale View, which is the working quarry across the road, has been working, and these two haven't been worked, but they're trying to suggest that because one of them has been worked since the permission, then all three should be classified as active. At the moment on site, we're just continuing with our defences on site, walkways, treehouses, the rest, you know. We really need more people. We're very busy at the moment, but we do really need more people. It's a really beautiful place, and this is really going to be the last chance to come and visit and to help stop this. I mean, obviously, we've been served our papers, and we are anticipating an eviction soon, but CPRE, which is the Council for the Protection of Rural England, are commissioning an independent report on the quality and quantity of stone that are left on the two sites. Stancliffe Stone and Haddon Estates have both agreed, and the Peak Park have all agreed, that they will look at this independent survey to try and see if there is an alternative, whether it is worth quarrying here, and whether they could actually take an alternative site. So, I mean, there are things still going on. We're still trying to challenge it legally. But we do need people on site, but we also need people to, you know, to work with us on our legal campaign, working with the locals, lobbying the Peak Park, who make the decision, lobbying Haddon Estates, who own the land, lobbying Marshalls and Stancliffe, who are also pushing through the plans to quarry.
Stancliffe Stone, who intend to open the quarries, want the stone to build a shopping mall and a church in America. They also have plans to open another 70 sites for quarrying. The eviction will cost millions, literally, and their specialist climbers and tunnellers who will have to work with the bailiffs and police to evict the protesters. If the eviction is successful, the campaigners say they intend to go to another area under threat and continue to fight against Stancliffe Stone. Yesterday, five bailiffs were caught on the protest site posing as campaign supporters, so many people are speculating that a massive eviction may come sooner rather than later. And now we go into a bit of Jimmy Cliff with Many Rivers. ¶¶
Sherwood Forest, a 300-year-old beech tree is at the heart of another protest campaign. Massive local support has been apparent since the tree camp was established 6 months ago. Bellway Homes are attempting to destroy a group of ancient trees and a natural meadowland to build what campaigners say is an unnecessary road junction. The area is supposedly guarded by a tree protection order as it possesses the 300-year beech tree. Campaigners hope they can delay the destruction long enough for action to be taken in the courts. Last week, the small numbers present were boosted by a call for support, which mobilised enough people to foil what they say was an illegal eviction attempt. The campaigners say they desperately need more people in sight to help build defences and to stay overnight, so numbers are at a maximum when the bailiffs move in. It seems likely it will happen very soon. Local campaigners and residents of the tree houses and tunnels were recently visited by the sheriff and informed that an eviction of the protest camp would be taking place very soon. Welsh bailiffs then entered the site with a warrant conducting a health and safety review. They said they would be returning imminently with a professional tunnel team and climbers. Meanwhile, 60-odd security and ambulance and cutting machine have been spotted hovering near the area. And later we'll be playing an audio interview with one of the campaigners in the Sherwood camp. For information on all of this madness and sadness, check the Indie Media site as well as Road Alert, www.roadalert.org.uk, and Schnooze at www.schnooze.org.uk.
And as if all that wasn't enough, other campaigns are feeling the pressure too. And here's a whole lot that we haven't mentioned. They include the Bargoed Bypass, where Caerphilly County Council, yes, those people responsible for the Blackwood Road scheme, also want to press ahead yet another questionable scheme. This bypass was described by the world-renowned transport expert, Professor John Whiteleg, as the worst road scheme I've ever seen in 25 years. It's an absolute dog's dinner, he said. The bypass will cut through a country park and will actually make journeys longer than the existing road, and it's being built for the sake of a new supermarket, even though the town has only got 6,000 people and two large supermarkets already. There's also a protest camp set up at Bilston, 8 miles south of Edinburgh, which is trying to stop the construction of a privately financed road. There's a campaign against a possible East Grinstead bypass, which will destroy an area of outstanding natural beauty and maybe even encroach on Ashdown Forest. And also in a scheme which has echoes of the M11, the Scottish Executive is planning to build a six-lane elevated motorway through the southern suburbs of Glasgow. The M74 Northern Extension, as it would be called, would be raised on 40 feet concrete stilts for parts of its journey. And at £375 to £500 million cost, it'll be the most expensive transport project in Scotland.
Excuse me. Moving back into the urban environment, but it's still a similar story. A derelict primary school in Colliers Wood, South London, has become a battleground between campaigners who want to preserve it and developers who want to turn it into housing. The well-organised locals occupied the school after the local council's decision to close it in August and sell the land to property developers Kings Oak Homes, part of the giant Barratt Group. Kings Oak Homes wants to demolish the school to build more housing. The squatters, on the other hand, have been running the school themselves as a social centre and free space since Christmas, with more than a dozen local children regularly using facilities, including a fully equipped computer area. The group, which calls itself Alternate Energies, say they want to protect the school for the future generations and have been forced to take action as the land is protected by a covenant that forbids any use other than education. In court this winter, however, the covenant was dismissed by a judge who ruled that now Kings Oak Homes has bought the property, the company can do whatever they want with it. On Monday, police and bailiffs moved in to remove the squatters, but were prevented when many, including local children, barricaded themselves onto the roof, dancing in the face of the heavies who'd come to turf them off their space. To try and force them out, a representative from King's Oak Homes entered the building and disabled the electrical circuits. The water was also turned off. But Alternate Energies is holding strong. A representative for the group named Dave said that the local area has no youth clubs or facilities for the local kids at all. We have cleaned this site up and are only interested in ensuring it is preserved as an educational and social space, said Dave. The group is interested in getting more people to visit, people who are interested in permaculture, alternative energies, and hard work.
Protesters win £80,500 damages from the police. Anti-monarchy protesters were celebrating recently after winning £80,500 in damages from the Metropolitan Police over their unlawful arrest and forced imprisonment on June 4, 2002, the Queen's Golden Jubilee. 23 people sued the Metropolitan Police, who settled out of court, and sent each of them a letter of apology. For the Queen's Golden Jubilee, the 4th of June 2002, because you probably wouldn't remember that date if you listen regularly to this show, more than 14,000 police were on duty as hundreds of thousands of people gathered in central London. Corporate people had yet again raised the spectre of anarchist troublemakers and violence, including this from The Observer, "Anarchists plan Jubilee mayhem." Some of the protesters had earlier in the day attended a public demonstration against the monarchy at Tower Hill, entitled Execute the Queen. A large joint police operation between the Met and City of London Police had confined the protest to a small area near Tower Hill Tube Station. As the protest ended, the demonstrators dispersed and some event-goers walked to the nearby Goodman's Field pub in Aldgate. They were followed by a group of around 40 to 50 police officers who waited outside and, following a briefing, entered the pub, encircling the group, by now seated and enjoying bank holiday lunchtime drink. Other customers looked on horrified as the police cautioned, filmed and led the revellers out one by one, making them stand in line on the pavement under the auspices of preventing a breach of the peace. The nature of the arrests was farcical. Officers asked each person in turn their intentions. Regardless of the answers, all 23 were summarily arrested. An officer notes that one arrestee stated categorically that he had no intention of breaching the peace. The officer records in his notes his reply to the man, "I believe you are here in the pub to cause a breach of the peace, therefore I am arresting you to prevent a breach of the peace."
According to The Guardian, the reason given for the detentions by officers was, quote, "intelligence from Chief Inspector Page that the group inside the pub may cause trouble." The arrest reports said arresting officers were told by their superiors to detain the anti-monarchists, whatever answers to the questions were given. The arrest report from one constable reads that he was briefed that, quote, "all answers are to be disbelieved." The police then commandeered a number 11 double-decker bus after flagging it down and turned it into a prison on wheels, driving around at high speed and dropping off the protesters, some of whom had been handcuffed, throughout the day at five different police stations across North, East, South London. No charges were ever brought against those arrested, and the individuals were released several hours later, just as the Jubilee celebrations were drawing to a close. A statement issued by the group of protesters reads, "This award, apology and acceptance of liability demonstrates that the police now accept no offences were committed, nor were they likely to be. We remain convinced that these tactics were employed, planned and coordinated in advance at a very senior level in order to remove any dissent against the monarchy or the Jubilee Day celebrations. All of the protesters will now receive £3,500 each and the letter of apology. On Thursday, the 5th of February, the protesters celebrated by presenting themselves with a massively enlarged letter of apology and the cheque for damages before boarding an open-top decorated double-decker bus and touring around central London, stopping off at New Scotland Yard, Buckingham Palace, Plumstead and Bishopgate police stations, which were two of the stations where they were taken, before finishing off where it all started at the Goodman's Field pub in Aldgate. They said they finally managed to finish the drinks they ordered 18 months ago.
Uncle Bob.
Bye.
And now for a little bit of international news. On Friday, February the 13th, unlucky for some, almost 8 months since their initial imprisonment, 13 people arrested during the EU protests summit in Thessaloniki last June have all had their charges dropped. Including the Briton Simon Chapman, who always maintained his innocence and even had video evidence showing that the police planted petrol bombs on his person. However, this evidence has been repeatedly rejected by the Greek judicial system despite being freely available on the internet in multiple languages and having been shown in the mainstream media. A prolonged hunger strike, which almost ended in tragedy, helped put their case on the agenda. Overall, the hunger strikers lasted for between 49 and 66 days, which finally culminated in their release on bail, but only after the medical team had been threatened with facing manslaughter charges if they did not force-feed the prisoners. One of the most important aspects was impressive solidarity shown throughout the world. Those involved see this as an enormous victory in the campaign against state repression against anti-capitalist protesters, although it must be remembered that the struggle for justice is not over yet, since several others still have outstanding cases.
Yes, so show some support for Carlos. All those arrested by the Italian police at the brutal raid on the Diaz school in Genoa following the anti-G8 protests in 2001 have had all their charges dropped. But there are still cases against 73 police involved in the raid, including senior officers who are facing trial for slander, false arrest, assault, battery and the abuse of authority, including, yet again, the planting of petrol bombs within the Diaz school, which they then used to try and justify the vicious beatings of scores of people.
Meanwhile, all eyes will be on the High Court in the UK tomorrow, where the outcome of the judicial review concerning over 100 anti-war protesters who were coach-napped by police last March will be announced. Much reported here and in the mainstream media, the case was an extraordinary example of police overstepping their powers by detaining over 100 people on three coaches on their way to a demonstration at RAF Fairford and forcibly returning them to London. You can check out the Indie Media website tomorrow morning for the outcome of that judicial review.
And months after the FTAA ministerial in Miami, things are starting to come into focus. Not that the global justice movement ever saw it out of focus, but the authorities are starting to see what happened in the streets of Miami. It's coming to light everywhere that the police in Miami used excessive force and were definitely not in the right, violating or completely ignoring First and Fourth Amendment rights. A judge hearing the cases of free trade protesters said in court that he saw no less than 20 felonies committed by police officers. This was a first step towards the realization of what happened. A member of the Civilian Investigative Panel, CIP, who had previously praised Police Chief John Timoney, resigned after his credibility was called into question by global justice activists. At the most recent CIP hearing, the Miami police admitted absolute responsibility for the way they treated activists.
Months after the FTAA ministerial... The Met Police spent nearly £4.5 million policing last year's Dicey Arms Fair, with over 1,600 officers protecting the arms dealers every day. Another fair is planned for 2005, and the Met Police are now asking the organisers themselves to foot the policing bill, with a £4.5 million price tag. The arms dealers will have to fork out even more than the £4.1 million that was spent on the policing of Bush's visit to England last November if they want to carry on with business as usual.
And we're almost running out of time. We've got a piece to play you out with, which is an interview with one of the protesters from the Sherwood Tree protest camp. We've been having a little difficulty with this piece of audio, so it may break up halfway through. But it's an interview with Cookie from the Sherwood Tree protest camp. And it's interesting that that campaign has been getting much more attention on the other side of the Atlantic in America, and indeed other countries, than it has here domestically at home, no doubt due to the kind of romantic way that a lot of people see Sherwood Forest. But it is quite amazing that it hasn't been getting much mainstream coverage here. We've run out of time. We were going to bring you some stories from Australia, Argentina, Latin America, and Australia again. And of course, check the Indie Media website, indiemedia.org.uk, for all of those stories and more.
And it's goodbye from us.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Well, so now we're moving to England, and we're speaking with Cookie Monster. Cookie, are you there?
I am, yes.
Right. Cookie, please tell us, there's been several incidents in the Sherwood Forest of Robin Hood fame where a developer or a predator, if you will, has attempted to invade this historical place in Britain. Could you just give us some background on the situation?
Sure. It's about a year ago now that quite a large wood, for us in England anyway, was taken. And we tried prosecuting because it was an illegal logging. And we found out that some of the ancient trees of Sherwood Forest were also due to go. So, as well as a legal case, we decided that we'd occupy the trees, and we've been doing that for 6 months now. It's getting very close because they obviously are getting very tight on the schedule, and it looks like they're going to be evicting us quite soon.
Now, your colleagues, have they sort of camped on the site? Are you relaying with them? And the sort of second point, have you seen local solidarity? Is there a movement underway to try to prevent any kind of incursion in Sherwood Forest?
The local support has been absolutely amazing. I think it's pretty unprecedented in this country for local people to support this kind of protest as much as they have here. They're coming over daily with food and with building equipment for us to do things there. And we're up in the trees. We've also tunneled under the ground. That's our major defence. The people here who try and fix people have great difficulty in dealing with people underneath the ground.
Cookie, we're on radio. Could you just give us an image of what the setting is like? Sherwood Forest is a forest. How big is this forest approximately? What is it? How many people are in the trees? And what does it look like? How can we get an image of the setting in Sherwood Forest? The resistance, the actions that are taking place.
We have a major beech tree here, and if you imagine a child has drawn a drawing of a tree, a big tree, that's exactly what this beech tree looks like. It's one of our most ancient trees, and it is just an absolute perfect tree. Sherwood Forest, by Canadian standards, is very small now. It's dwindling. There's hardly anything left. I mean, for instance, we've just got 40 trees here that we're trying to protect. I mean, in Canada, in the same amount of space as the whole of Sherwood Forest, you'd have at least 100 times that. So to us, we're protecting the equivalent of 4,000 trees. So, you know, we haven't got much left now. Mm-hmm. We're just trying to save what's left. Our beech tree, actually, it would take 5 people to hold hands around it. And we don't have many trees like that in this country. It's one of the very, very few that's left. And to touch trees like this, you know, it shouldn't be down to us to end a tree's life like that. It really shouldn't.
Cookie, tell us a bit about the developer. What is the logic behind the the development scheme? I mean, has there been a public consultation to discuss with the developer exactly what is stands to be lost in this project? And if not, why was there an absence of public transparency regarding this developer and his target, which is Sherwood Forest?
I mean, we've got very little building land left in this country, so what the developers now go for building houses is what they call brownfield sites, which is sites that have been used for something else before. There used to be a Sherwood Colliery. They used to mine for coal, and that closed down almost 20 years ago now. They're building a housing estate there, and we don't have a problem with that. You know, that's far better than greenfield space. But as part of that development, they want to put a new road through all these trees. It's totally unnecessary. There are other routes to the sites which wouldn't disturb trees, and that's what we're fighting them on. We went to the consultation meetings about this development, and we specifically asked, would any trees be touched? And they said that they wouldn't. And we're just absolutely amazed that suddenly we find out that all along they had intentions to take these trees.
Does the historical element or that mythological element of Sherwood Forest, does that have any impact on your of the reasons why Sherwood Forest are so important?
I don't think that, you know, we seem to not look in the past as much as we should here. You know, we're always looking for the future. We're always looking to develop and progress. We don't look backwards nearly enough. We don't look at the lessons of the past. We certainly don't consider our history as important as other countries think of our history. It's amazing. You know, all the forests in the world, I think that most people have heard of Sherwood Forest and the mythologies around Robin Hood. And it's an absolute ideal area for people to come to visit. You know, tourism is a trade which, if handled right, isn't destructive. And all we need to do is leave the area as it is to attract tourists. And yet they seem to be destroying what the only thing that tourists would have of interest in our area. It's really crazy.
Cookie, so we're seeing a site which is part of Britain's cultural heritage threatened. And could you give us an idea of the timeline? What is the next step as far as the activism is concerned to stop this incursion into the site? And what are the authorities doing right now as we speak to pressure activists to leave the site?
We're right at the end of the road now. I mean, we have so many legal cases on the go, but they're trying to try and beat us, evicting us and cutting down the trees before we get this to court. We've had bailiffs actually visiting the site, which is basically the last sign you're going to get before they actually come in. They've wrecked the site, they've looked it over, and they've worked out how they're going to try and get it out. So we're just going to have to dig in and hold the trees for as long as possible and hope that a court order comes in before the trees come down.
When I'm on the phone.